But that training, this is tape number two of conversation with Bertie Tebbutts on October 29th, 1992. Lucky to get that training, but that was from the time that you started catching in the big leagues, and even before.
Well, I knew that
It
part of it.
didn't. It just didn't happen in
No.
1952 in
What
Indianapolis.
I did know was pitching. I knew pitching. I had caught some of the greatest pitchers who ever lived. And I'd caught on winning championship clubs. And I knew what pitchers had to do. And I let the other guys play. If you let the guys play, I had Jimmy Dykes as my coach. Jimmy Dykes was a great manager. He had losing clubs, but he was a great manager. And I said to him one day, "Is McMillan over far enough?" And he said, "Why are you asking me?" And I said, "Well, I kind of feel," and he said, "Let him stay where he is, Bertie." And right about that time, there was the goddamnest line drive you ever saw, right at McMillan. And the game went on, and after the game was over, Jimmy came in. I had all my coaches come in after every game. Jimmy came in, and I said, "Okay, Jim, why? Why did you tell me that?" And he said, "Because sometimes managing, we get so smart, we never give the ball players credit for being smart themselves." And he said, "I figure McMillan has been around long enough to know what the hell he was doing without any help from you." Well, it was a great lesson for me to learn, you know. And
When to say something, when to keep your mouth shut.
yeah, give the ball player credit and let him play. You know, I told a guy if he could steal a base and he wanted to look at me, and I'd say yes. And if the situation was bad for the lineup, where I didn't want him thrown out, and I explained it to them, then I don't want you to go because you might get thrown out, and if you do, I won't have the right guys hitting in the next inning. So there's no test tube for managing. You don't get a diploma. You get manager of the year, but you don't get a raise.
By the way, would you we were going to say, what did you sign for with the Reds in 54? Or you don't have to,
No,
but
I don't. I won't tell you what it
okay.
was, but I will tell you this. And this is kind of funny. While we were negotiating the contract, I said, "Gabe, that's not much money. I can make that managing in Indianapolis." And he said, "I know it. We are not a rich club. But I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you X number of dollars for every 50,000 people we draw over six. Every 50,000 people we draw over 600,000 as an incentive." And I said, "Okay." We got into the season, and all of a sudden he says to me, "Your bonus is starting today." Now, we had a month to go. And the one thing a manager doesn't want to do is to price himself out of business, because the world is full of managers.
Okay.
Not full of second basemen,
That's right.
shortstop, but it's full of managers. And
Especially
that's the thought that went through my mind. I've had a happy year. There's no reason for me to be unhappy. I was in the insurance business. Everything was going all right. I went in and I said, "Gabe, I don't like this thing about getting money for every 50,000, because we're at six. We're liable to do four or more, and that's a lot of money." And he said, "Let me tell you something. I'm working for your salary, and I get get double the amount that you're getting on the 600,000. And I said, "Okay." And I walked out. At the end of the year, for the first time, I'm owed this money. I said, "Gabe, I'd like to have you send me to Europe, looking for ball players in Italy and places like that, and he started to laugh, and he said, no, and he said, I do want you to know that Crosley is very happy that you earned this money. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're going to go to Europe? I said, Mary and I would like you, and he said, we'll send you. So Mary and I, and I did have to look, talk to the people over there. They had army groups, and Italy had baseball teams.
Oh, that's right. You had a lot of U.S. military.
I had to turn a report on this stuff. Like it was the beginning of today. They have basketball and everything.
Yeah.
But they sent me over there, and that was in 56, when we drew 1,000,002.
That's right. That was an all-time record. Crosby bought the Reds back in the late 30s, I think, from a bank syndicate that said banks don't belong in the baseball franchise business, and he built cars and refrigerators. And
he was an inventor.
Inventor? I guess he left Gay Paul and you really take care of the daily operations. And he really wasn't involved in that. But
there was one ball player he didn't like.
Uh-huh.
And it's a good ball player.
I guess you don't want to say his name.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Because it's not fair.
Okay. Well, we'll
I think every owner doesn't like
I'm
one
sure
ball
there's
player.
It must be. Yeah. Charlie Finley didn't like a whole bunch of them.
When he'd start on this guy, no matter what he was doing, this conversation would get around, and finally he would say, I don't like so-and-so. I don't think it would. We'd change the subject as soon as we could.
1958 in August, a lot of trades occurred over between the 57 and 58 season. And the Reds ended up back in second division.
Right.
I guess those trades really didn't gel and really strengthen the team that you had thought, you and Gay Paul had thought would occur.
Well, once again, you get down to playing the cards that you're dealt.
But didn't you and Gabe decide who was to be traded and who was to stay?
Pretty much.
Okay.
And you think you're making a good deal. We made a hell of a deal when we got Jeffcoat from the Cubs.
Uh-huh.
And we made a great deal when we got Perky. And we made a great deal when we got Brooks Lawrence. And Smokey Burgess helped us tremendously. And at no time, and once again, I don't want to pick out individuals. I want to pick out the whole staff.
Yeah.
Crosley said something to Gabe and me one time about the pitching staff, not related to Ferrick.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me what I thought of him, and I said, well, Mr. Crosley, we put waivers on every one of our pitchers, and only one of them was claimed. So that there isn't any ball club in the league that wants any one of our pitchers. I hope that answers your question. Of course, I'll never name the one that was claimed.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything is to be written about Cincinnati, it's got to be written by Gabe Paul. If that man would write a book, it would be the greatest baseball book ever written.
Where's he live?
Where is he?
Mm-hmm.
He's in Tampa.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, but he wouldn't talk to you.
Even through the Hall of Fame?
No.
Okay.
No, he wouldn't talk to anybody.
Okay.
He's that kind of a person.
Okay.
But my book might have some of it.
Well, I look forward to reading your book then, Bertie.
Yeah, well, it's kind of cute.
Well, Cincinnati has a rich baseball heritage. You know, it's the oldest professional baseball team in the major leagues.
Well, they proved that they were a great baseball city in 50 city and in the 40s. I played in the 1940 World Series against Cincinnati. That was one of the reasons I thought, and I said so, I think that I will be well liked in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And the writer said, why? And I said, I played in the series in 40 and never got a hit. And they came, the McKechnie years, they drew 600,000, which was a lot. World Series were sellouts. It was a great baseball city.
Yeah.
And they drew from the whole territory, including Kentucky. And when Jackie Robinson came in there, they just didn't have any tickets left. You know, the whole state of Kentucky came up to see Jackie. Yeah. So that it's a good baseball city. People. A
lot of innovations in baseball started there.
Yes, they did. Ladies' Day was in before, but the uniforms. I had to wear the first of the uniforms that they put on, sleeveless and stuff like that.
Did Kluziski really start that, or was this something that?
No, Kluziski just had it. He was so muscular that the baseball sleeve was tight on his arm.
Uh-huh.
So he cut it off here so that he could move his arm. And I don't think there's anything more tougher than if you're going like this, I can feel that shirt.
Yeah, that's right. You know?
And he didn't want to feel anything, so he just wore the shirt, and it was a trademark.
But is that how it started, or did the sleeveless say?
No, we had the sleeveless then.
Oh, did
you? His jets were a little shorter than ours.
Okay.
Yeah. And they had the vest type uniform with the red shirts. And they were the first ones to put air conditioning into a player's dugout, which was great. General Electric put in the experiment, and they ran the air conditioning around the front of the dugout, and of course we had it, and the other ball clubs started to raise hell, and then we had to put it in there.
We had to have some equality about it, so you had to run across the
turnabout is fair play.
Well, of course, night baseball began there, and I think back at the turn of the century when the modern era began, that's when, or even before then, that baseball gloves were introduced.
Right.
Any other thoughts about managing before I would ask you a couple of questions about the quarterback of a baseball team, the art of catching?
Well, about managing, you got to let the man play.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have control of your players. You don't ask a player to do something he can't do, because if you do, he'll hate you. And if you do that, and you're trying to protect yourself, the ball players will know you don't have any guts. It's better to let a guy hit than to make him do something he can't do. Although recent World Series, they had a big hitter bunt. Winfield.
Yes, that's right.
Winfield is a great athlete. Winfield can do anything. And this was a World Series, and Winfield can bunt a ball. So he did not ask Winfield to do anything that he couldn't do. But if it were Boog Powell, and they asked him to bunt.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, everybody would say the same thing, including the players.
Manager would be the laughingstock of the team.
Those kind of guys, they want to finish 10 games ahead of their team. Charlie Dressen was a guy like that. They said of him, he's going to manage. I hope he does well. And the thing is, well, I don't know whether he'll do well or not, but he'll finish ahead of his team.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty good remark about guys who they're engaged in the course and the play of a ball game, and they absolutely positively cannot resist asking a guy to do something which, if it fails, he'll blame the player, and if it succeeds, they'll give him credit for having a lot of guts. He wants the credit for winning the game. I don't know whether this is true or not, but I bet that it is. Jackie Robinson was asked to squeeze bunt a guy in, and I know who the manager was. That's the kind of a manager he was. You can't do it. You can't lose the respect of your
Well, they say a player's manager. that term, the which you're describing to me, comes to mind yourself, Kelly of the Minnesota Twins.
Yes, he's one of the...
I think Phil Gardner of the Orioles did it this year.
Burden.
I'm sorry?
Burden.
Yeah. Bill Burden.
Right.
I think Bucky Showalter tried to do it with the Yankees this year, and they've played 10...
They've got it to prove, if they allow them.
Yes, that's right.
And Austin, by all means.
Yeah.
And the other types, everybody knows who they are.
Yeah.
And they just take advantage of the players.
You went over... well, let's talk about catching. That's your background.
Yeah.
That's the quarterback of a baseball team.
Let me say one more thing about
please.
A man.
Okay.
I hope you're going to edit it. If you don't, it's all right.
I'm not planning on editing anything, Bertie.
All right. Then a manager in the days before today, when he got a job, he brought his own managers with him. There weren't farm systems like there are now. And you could see McCarthy manage, and he had Fletcher and Schulte.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he went to the Red Sox to manage, Schulte came with him. And Crosetti came in while McCarthy was there, and Crosetti stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everybody, when Lopez took a job, you knew that Berries was going to be his pitching coach, and that Cuccinello was going to be his coach.
Mm-hmm.
And O'Neill had guys. Now, a lot of times, managers in those days were not as secure in their job as they are now, and they had every right to not be, and they brought in with them their friends who were loyal to them, because in those days, there was a lot of second-guessing going on a ball club. Within the hierarchy of the club.
You're general manager on a...
Yeah. There's one famous little guy who's around now, and he's famous for wanting to get the job of his manager when he's his coach. Now, everybody would like to manage.
Sure.
And it's no sin to say so. But when you work behind the scenes to undercut your coach by one little word to one little writer, you know,
it'll snowball.
That's the kind of a guy they were afraid of in the old days. Now, a manager can have his coach, but he also accepts or has to accept guys who have worked for years in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And they're outstanding coaches, and they're loyal. There isn't any of that going on, but that was always a trademark of, mm-hmm. of a manager. And you never think about it, and it's not fair for me to say this because it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want to mention it, but when Lachman got the job, his brother came with him.
To do what?
To be the pitching coach.
Oh.
And that's not why he came. The guy who came is a hell of a coach.
Mm-hmm.
But it did make one think about, you know, when DeRocher, he had Stanky. He had all of his own people. And Alston went in there and accepted. He accepted DeRocher as a third base coach. You talk about guts.
That would be.
Yeah, and DeRocher did everything he could to cut him up. But that's neither.
I don't think that marriage, in my book, would last more than 15 days.
It did, only because everybody understood, and
yeah.
Alston let it go. Alston was a big, tough guy. It is told. I'm not sure that it's so. That one day early on in Alston's career in the major leagues in Brooklyn, somebody made a remark to Alston And he told that guy that anytime he wanted him to come and get him, and he'd accommodate him. And that goes for any of the rest of you guys. If you want a piece of me, come and get me. And that put a hush. And there were guys in there who could lick him, but they really appreciated the fact that he wasn't a pushover. So that, anyway, I wanted to get that coaching thing in about the manager.
Okay.
And getting fired, you know when you're going to get fired. There's never a surprise.
Is that why you resigned before they fired you?
Always. Always.
You knew it was coming.
Yeah. And I usually knew where I was going.
So you knew you were going over to Milwaukee?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
No, I didn't. I didn't know that I was going to Milwaukee because I went there as a an executive.
That's right.
And.
But when you left Cincinnati, you went over to Milwaukee, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay, and so you left managing until you... To go in the front office.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that? I mean, that's a big transition.
Well, it wasn't for
was
me.
There
I wasn't worried about handling people because I handled people in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't worried about baseball players because I was a baseball player. And I was a manager. And the only thing left for me was to do something like that. I'd want to be the executive mm-hmm. vice president of Milwaukee Brave. I was going to be the president, and I'm not dumb enough to think that I can't do those things and get the world by the tail. And I went over there into a horrible situation.
Well, I mean, they were a fantastic team, 57-58.
I went there in 62. I managed in 62.
That's right.
Yeah. I went there in 58.
Yeah. That's right, in 58.
But that, you know, the Milwaukee Braves were at the top of the list.
Yeah, but I wasn't in uniform. The situation I ran into was in the office. And it was horrible. And it was the reason I quit. But that's going to be in my book.
Okay.
I'll get sued on that one.
Okay. Well, we'll stop that.
Well, let me say this.
Okay.
The toughest job a manager has is to try to work under a person who not only does not know anything about baseball, but who thinks he does.
Mm-hmm. That can go with any job.
That might be, but you try to manage in front of all the people in the world, and you pick up a paper and you've got some guy making a statement,
mm-hmm.
and it's a can't-win situation, and you go into the office and work for that same guy, and you suggest this and suggest that because it's a baseball thing,
mm-hmm.
and they give you a ridiculous answer. It's happening now. People are getting involved in the transfer of a ball club. And there are non-baseball people who are interfering with this whole process. And
he doesn't want your cholesterol. Do you?
I'll take a bite.
The same could be said about any situation involving a manager.
Mm-hmm.
I had one guy who was a part owner of the Cleveland Ball Club, and after every game we lost, he wrote me a letter. And he was the head of a corporate law firm. He was a very, very bright, brilliant man. But he just was baseball nuts, and he thought he was smart.
Well, of course, there are a lot of people that could be millionaires in a business and
yeah.
buy a ball club and leave their intelligence behind. We
yeah.
see that over and over again today.
Well, generally we get pretty good owners.
Oh.
You know.
Okay. I don't know any of them personally, but...
Yeah. There are some who want to change the world.
Well...
The trouble is they affect the lives of the people. I think the one thing that's missing in the game today is that new ownership comes in. There is no loyalty involved in keeping the personnel that was there for 20 years, 25 years. They're going to change the general manager, the farm director, the scouts, and it's going to be the same old story. The scouts are going to do all the work and get none of the credit. It's a shame. about them not being eligible for the Hall of Fame.
Well, that may change, though. Is there any movement to change that?
Yes, there is. There
I don't know.
I think they should be eligible for the Hall of Fame.
Of course, they have umpires. We have baseball announcers. We have...
They're not in the Hall of Fame, the baseball people. I mean, the writers.
Are they...
They're in a section.
A section of
the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
They're voted in by their own people. And they are in the Hall of Fame. And I suppose they can go around bragging that they are in the Hall of Fame. And they have done great work, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But they didn't work for baseball.
Bertie, as a catcher, you've seen a big change in catching equipment as well as styles of catching.
Well, that's...
What kind of... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That kind of a change is expected. There are certain phrases that they use now that we didn't use to describe situations. They are intended to make you look smart.
That's all right.
Cross the seams, with the seams, mm-hmm. not using the seams. A knuckleball with a small hand here and this hand there. So what?
Yeah.
You know, it's the only function that a catcher has, catching, is to do everything he can do to win a ball game for his pitcher and for his team. No other function. If you can go to a ball game and the game is 1-0 or 2-1 and you don't know who caught the game, you were looking at a good catcher. But if you start a ball game off and the Boston Red Sox are playing, and they have famous pitchers pitching, and you look at their catcher, and he looks like an Indian having a dump in the woods. His butt is on the ground. He catches the ball one-handed all the time.
One leg sprawled out.
He is putting on a show for him, and the pitchers can't like it. There are certain things that one does that does not help a pitcher. For example, we just saw a series of games where the catcher for one ball club gave the sign, sat in the position where he had given the sign, and as the pitcher got ready to pitch the ball, he jumped up. He had no time to get himself ready. Had no time to give the pitcher a target. He had the one thing a pitcher needs when he turns is to pick up where he's going to throw the ball. Mm-hmm. And this club led the league in wild pitches. The old theory was, and it's still all right, you catch a ball in the strike zone. They call it a box now.
Mm-hmm.
I'll guarantee you one thing. Whenever I see a catcher move out on the hitter and get away with it, on the hitter, doesn't get away with it on the umpire,
mm-hmm.
because 9 pitches out of 10 will be balls when he moves out.
Yeah.
But it shows the lack of discipline of the hitters. They're up there hitting, and they don't use their vision to pick up the catcher and where he is. And they can't find him, so they know he's in here, and they turn for an inside fastball.
Right.
And if they're out there where they can see him, they know it's going to be a slider out over the plate. Bogs. You do that on bogs, on wind, or those kind of guys, you're in trouble. You know, they'll hit you a home run to left field instead of a home run to right. But the job of a catcher is to do the best thing he can do to help the pitcher to win a ball game. And that is to give them the right target, to give them encouragement, which they don't do. I don't think a catcher says one word in the course of a ball game. I missed that terribly because I used to love to talk a lot during a game. But
that was your reputation.
Yeah.
You never did talk to the batter?
Always. Yeah, but everybody talked. Shortstop at second baseman would say, cover me in the hole, I'm going to guard the line. And the center fielder would look at the outfielder and give him a sign saying he was going to go behind and all those things. But you could hear everybody, and there was an enthusiasm. And you didn't get a chance to do too much of your own thinking. They'd help you do it. And the catcher's job is to keep reminding the pitcher not to get careless about anything. He doesn't have to be a mastermind. He doesn't have to say anything, except don't let him hit the ball through the box. Just walk out there. There's only a few things you have to say to a pitcher when you walk out there. Don't get careless. Don't get lazy.
Help him get his concentration back.
Just turn him around somewhere. Roll your hips. The best thing in the world a catcher can say to a pitcher is roll your hips.
Roll your hips.
Roll your hips. Now that's going to sound silly, and it's going to sound silly to the people who are hearing it.
Well?
But when I was catching in the minor leagues in Texas, we had a general manager who didn't know a baseball from a tennis ball. And he would walk by me and he'd say, trouble with McLaughlin is he's not rolling his hips. And he'd keep on walking. And I'd start laughing. And all of a sudden, one day I had a pitcher who was outside, right-hand pitcher who was out on the first third base side of the plate. And I went out to him and I said, roll your hips a little bit. And I went back to catch and he did. And it worked. But the point I'm trying to make is that you have to say something that's believable.
Mm-hmm. So
you can't walk out there on a Morris or a guy who's been pitching for 20 years and help him. You can slow him up.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell him that he doesn't have the spin on his slider that he had, or that his changeup is a little too fast. But you can't tell him how to pitch or do anything. You have to help him and not teach him. And then you have to catch, first of all, you have to catch a shutout. That's the first thing you got to do. Can't try to pick a guy off second base with one man out when you're ahead 5-0. Because if you throw badly and the guy goes to third, he scores on a fly ball and the pitcher loses the shutout. And you lose the pitcher. Nothing is said. But as time goes on, you try to pick a guy off third base with two men out, you better pick his ass off.
That's right.
See?
Better have it on the money.
That's right. And the same thing with a guy on first base. You try to pick a guy off first base that's got one stolen base in 2 years, and you're just showing off.
Trying to help your own stats.
That's all. Catcher who's going to throw should throw in the first or second inning.
Mm-hmm.
Bang, bang. And then the guys on the bench say, watch this guy, he likes to throw. And then you don't have to throw anymore. But you get back to the basic thing that a catcher has to do. He has to catch a pitcher the best way that that pitcher can pitch to get the best results against the hitter that's hitting. Now that sounds kind of silly. But you can't catch in the big leagues for any less than 5 years without being a good major league catcher. You have to know all of your pitches. Now these are the veterans I'm talking about. You have to know all of your pitches. You have to know all of the hitters in the league.
That's right.
Now you're not going to worry about a guy, a Belliard. Why the hell are you going to worry about him? He hasn't hit a home run in 10 years. And you don't want to walk him.
Mm-hmm.
But you are concerned when the third baseman gets up or when the left fielder gets up. And now all of a sudden the catcher for the other club is hot. And you're concerned about how to pitch him because You don't need a chart, you don't need statistics. You need a catcher who knows what he's doing, and he can relate to the hitter, because the hitter changes his stance. Mm-hmm. That means he's going to pull, or he's going to right field. Mm-hmm. Or he steps a little bit away from the plate where he can't go anyplace else but right field. And the guy on the bench is calling a pitch and moving the defense when the catcher's right there and he sees it all.
So you got to digest all that in 1 or 2 seconds.
It takes 5 years to do it.
5 years to learn that.
Yeah, 5 years. And you can't, unless you have caught great pitchers, you don't know what it takes to be a great pitcher.
Tell me,
if
too.
You caught Feller and you caught Bridges, and Bridges is a curveball pitcher and maybe the best curveball that you ever caught.
Talking about Rocky Bridges?
No, I'm talking about Tommy Bridges.
Okay.
He was in the 30s and 35, 36, and a great, great pitcher for Detroit with probably the best curveball anybody ever had. He gave up a triple against the Cubs in the World Series and struck out the next three batters with 9 curveballs. That was Tommy Bridges. But you just got to not catch the guy into trouble and to use what you know against the hitter. And all you got to have, and I said to Joe McCarthy one day, and Red Rolfe was a great friend of mine. He was from New Hampshire, about 30 miles up from where I lived. And I said, Joe, Red Rolfe has always got a bunch of notes in his hand. He said he needs them. He's got a short memory. Well, to me, that was okay.
Yeah.
But he said to me one day, he said, you had to throw him the fastball, huh, Bertie? And I looked at him and I started to laugh. Charlie Keller was a hell of a ball player. Al Benton was a great pitcher with a good curveball. Keller got up. We struck him out on 3 curves. Next time up, we struck him out with 3 curves. I'm not saying we didn't throw the fastball. We didn't throw it for a strike. Mm-hmm. Next time up, we get bing, bing, 2 curveball strikes. And now Ben's got a pretty good fastball, and there's a couple of men on. Mm-hmm. And fellas up there really, Keller's up there really pressing. So I called for the fastball, and it was in the upper deck. Before you could even hear the ball hit the bat, it was in the upper deck. A hell of a fastball in a good spot. Now, how many years later? 5? I'm catching for McCarthy. And I'm catching a ball game. And I call the pitch. And nothing really happened, but it was a situation where I shouldn't have called the pitch. And when I walked into the bench, he said, remember Charlie Keller, Bertie? That's what he meant when he said, a guy has a short memory. Man. There isn't anything that you can... A guy hitting 1 for 5 is batting 200.
Mm-hmm.
2 for 6, he's batting 333.
That's right.
So why wouldn't you put the guy up to hit pinch hitters batting 1 for 5? Mm-hmm. If he gets a base hit, he's 2 for 6.
That's right.
So there's so much... Statistics do not give you the answer that you need in the play of the game. They might, but if a guy is hitting 450 mm-hmm. against a guy, that means he gets 4 hit and 6 times at bat. And if the last 3 times he hit, he got 3 hits, mm-hmm. then he's got some outs coming. You know, it's...
Yeah. Well, I know baseball announcers have cranked up more meaningless statistics.
The ball clubs are to blame, you know, they feed them that stuff.
Well, I guess so, but some of it is so irrelevant, has nothing to do with a baseball game.
Well,
maybe it helps on the salary negotiations.
Well, okay, that's one of the problems that we have. When the play of the game today, the ball players play the game because of their agents and there's an end result of the stats. Doesn't make any difference how the game went or how the team goes, as long as the stats are there, they're happy.
Bertie, to come to a conclusion here, we've been at it about another 2 hours again, and I could come back 10 more times if you would be so gracious, but it comes the time to conclude it.
I like to talk baseball.
I know you do, and I have the privilege and pleasure of sitting here in your living room that no other kid in America has.
I guess I'm jumping on this because the first time I've been able to.
Good.
Go ahead, Dan.
That I played baseball as a kid. I still play softball today. And I love to win with the best of them. I never was good enough to become a professional ball player, but that didn't keep me from enjoying the ball game. And so I, as a ball player, I have it in my dreams. If I had a second life to be reincarnated, let me tell you, it will be as a ball player. And I know baseball also is a game of storytelling, some of it fact, and some of it fiction. And I just wanted to thank you for allowing me to come into your home to, as a stranger, to meet you, and that I have the opportunity to hear some of these from a great storyteller.
Well, you're refreshing my memories, Dan. I appreciate that. And that's why I'd like to have them back, because I want that stuff.
Okay.
It comes by only once in a while through your mind, unless you are gigged. You know, tell us about, and then you tell the stories.
Yeah. Well, I I do a lot of research, and not that I know a lot of stories about different ball players or who had what recollection, their experience with what one, but anyway, I'll make copies of this. I think you want two or three copies?
No, two would be good.
Okay, and I'll be sending those to you. The master copies go to Bill Guilfoyle.
Yeah, well, he's a great man.
Yes, he is. I've never met the man.
Haven't you?
I only corresponded with him. I got a letter from him yesterday, and I always tell him that when I'm going back to make a second visit or something like that, and or pick up the phone. I've talked with him any number of times, but I've never. I hope sometime, maybe this coming summer, that I go back to the Hall of Fame and as a visitor and have the opportunity to meet him at that time.
There are some great people in the Hall of Fame building, but I think he's the glue that keeps it all together. Yeah. If he tells you something, you can go to the bank with it.
Yeah. Well, he's given me this opportunity to meet people like you. And
it's unique.
Yes, it is.
It's a unique experience.
Uh-huh. Oh, it is. As a kid growing up in Kansas, I never in my wildest dream would have ever thought something like this would have. And I don't say it just to be spreading on a lot of charm, just a fact of life, and I'm going to enjoy it as much as I can and do the best of my ability.
You'll be in the Hall of Fame, Dan.
Well, I'm going up there, and I'll have my grandchildren someday, and I said, now I want
your
Thank you very much.